Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Snow Ice Adventures, whatever that means. For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geeksone.com. Hey!
Hello, my geeklings!
Another fine episode right before...
So long.
Right before Nerd Prom. Geek Comic Con, yep. Which is this coming up week.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
If only all of you out there in listener land could see the humming of anticipation on Aaron and Peter's face right now.
I like going to Comic Con.
It's fun. Like a week before Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun. You go down there, we see all the nerds and geeks, we become a nerd and geek, we drink, have some booze, eat some food, hang out with friends.
Are you going for each day that's going to be there?
I'm going to be there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay.
So I'm not going to... Are you going, Clint? Oh, by the way, this is Clint.
Hello.
We'll introduce ourselves.
We are actually 50% less Asian this week.
Yes.
Right.
We want to take
the
moment to...
We're more white this week, I guess.
We want to take the moment to wish our fourth geek, Matt, who is currently on his second honeymoon in the exotic Bora Bora, wherever the hell he is, having a good time.
His first honeymoon was victim to a hurricane.
Yeah.
So yes. He got a rain check.
Literally.
For real.
Yes.
And he's back again.
And it's cool that he's been Twittering some of his stuff on that he's been doing. So it's cool to see like what he's doing on the fly.
And doesn't he have a blog now, too?
He does, but I don't think he's updating it on the fly. But if anybody wants to follow his Twitter account, just go to Twitter. And you can find him through me. My Twitter account is Aaron H, spelled with a zero, A-A-R-0-N-H. And then you can find him through me as well. And so he's been Twittering all, you know, that he flew in a prop plane on a dirt. There's like cows on the runway. They had a Dodge and stuff like that. So it's fun because he's doing that like, you know, on the moment that's happening. So it's fun.
So luckily for us, we have an extra geek subbing in for Matt this week.
Hello.
Hello. That would be Clint.
Yes. So, Clint. Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
Hi, my name is Don. I am a video game professional and writer here in sunny Hollywood, and I, too, am a geek.
My name's Clint Keepin. I am a stand-in here in Los Angeles, and I, too, am a geek.
My name is Pete Robinson, and I'm a screenwriter here in Los Angeles, and I am a geek.
Stand-in.
Well, for those of you who actually have listened to this show for a while, you know that all four of us have always been involved in some way with the entertainment industry, and mm-hmm. Clint is, in fact, keeping with that tradition.
Was that a pun?
Keeping with that tradition?
The brunch. Clint keeping.
It's
funny.
A good one. Yeah.
Because it's his name.
Someone put some crickets, please.
So we have Clint is an actor.
I'm trying to marshal up some laughter there. Come on, try to make one with my name.
Let's get some Hendrix playing in the background. I don't know.
Yeah.
I got nothing. I was biblical with it.
I was gambling on you not being able to. Come on, people.
He was.
Come on. Ouch. I've said it all. Oh,
he was robbing some bad jokes there.
Is this because Matt's not here? You feel like you have to fill in the blanks?
Oh, you think you're the king of comedy? Boom. I got them all. Thanks. Next. Let's move on.
Stop yanking my chain.
Yang King.
Oh, that's bad.
Because it's Matt Yang King.
Yeah. Ah! All right, we're done.
Glad we're on that tangent.
We're done with the attempted humor, which didn't really work.
We can edit that, right?
How was your guys' geek week?
Oh, I am in geek hell right now. Mm. I am releasing video games. This is my very first time having to actually negotiate my ways through... Nintendo video game submissions, and I'm not even doing it myself. I'm not even the guy steering the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just helping someone else submit these games, and already my life is hell. So
well, that's no good.
I don't even want to know what
video games should be joyous.
Well, yeah, it's a remote. You know, okay. The reasons why people who love video games should not make video games. Mm. You know, let's just say this is one of them.
So this week was E3, was your company involved with that, or does E3 affect you?
Actually, it's sort of weird the way things worked out. E3 is much smaller than any other year, right? For those of you who have been to E3 in the past, E3 has taken up the entirety of the Los Angeles Convention Center,
which
is one of the largest convention centers in the world. It's enormous. This year, E3 is constrained to the Concourse Hall.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who are not familiar with what the Concourse Hall is, it's the little hallway that runs between the two main areas of the convention center, where in prior years, a few startup companies scraped together enough money just to have like a 5x5 booth where they're trying to pitch their new, like, you know, it's a console system controller.
And for some reason, LucasArts was always deciding to jam themselves in there.
Well, they like to think of themselves as being indie and edgy.
Yeah. But they're not. It's not open to the public now. That's correct.
Well,
it never has been open to the public.
People used to sneak in, but it's never been open to the public.
Oh, right, but now it's hard to get in, even if you're industry.
Yeah.
But it's smaller. I thought they weren't even going to hold it anymore. I thought it was disbanded.
It's there.
Okay.
But it's sort of transformed. So, for example, my company did not have a presence at E3,
mm-hmm.
but our office is about two blocks from E3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we just basically invited every company that had a presence there, every press junket that was going to have a presence.
To come
and,
over.
Yeah, and I spent 3 days demoing our different games for press people.
Well, that's what I think a lot of people had hotel rooms set up and across the streets, and that they were demoing their products off-site.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And not only that, but, you know, really, the big companies invited all the press a week or 2 weeks or even 3 weeks before E3, you know, EA and Microsoft's and all that. Their big pitches were done beforehand, and they just tell them to shut up.
That was to overshadow E3,
the only
right?
big companies I noticed that were not there, at least on some level, were Activision and EA.
Right.
Everyone else at least had a small booth.
Well, yeah. You know. I know LucasArts just also pulled out, but they're not really that
not
big.
Activision's
huge. I mean, those are the two. Activision and EA not being there. In fact, I'm even wondering if there's going to be an E3 at all next year.
You know what? Judging if other companies had as much success actually getting press coming in as we did, for us, it was great.
Okay.
But mind you, we didn't have to lay out any cash for it. So, we just invited people and gave them lovely gift baskets. So
has this been more beneficial for the smaller companies than...
I can't speak for other companies, but for us, I think we got some pretty good coverage.
Hmm.
You know.
Well, normally I'm down at E3, and I don't get to do that this year. But I thought G4 did a really good job this year of covering it all day. They had all the press conferences uninterrupted, Monday and Tuesday, and then. Monday through Friday, really, they had like probably 2 or 3 hours of coverage, and all it was developers bringing in their game and doing hands-on demonstrations. It wasn't the G4 bullshit where they do skits and, you know, talk in circles over and over. It was straight demos for 3 hours.
That's good.
I thought I probably even saw more that way than in the past where you're waiting in lines and stuff at E3. I thought G4 did a great job.
I actually think the new form of E3 is not necessarily a bad choice. I know you're definitely against it, but...
The only thing I'm against is not having hype. Because, and if E3 dies out and then there isn't a week where G4 can cover video games and we all get excited and we're all checking the internet every 5 minutes to see what new demos have been posted on, you know, Team Xbox, that type of stuff, that would be sad if essentially video game week went away.
Right.
Because if the movie industry could drum that up right now, they totally would do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If the movie industry had movie week, they would jump on it big time.
Of course, they're doing pretty well this year.
But the movie industry?
Yeah. From what I've
heard. They're always doing well. They're always bitching about something.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, sales on theaters have been going up, if I understand correctly.
Because people don't have the money to go anywhere else, so they're going out to films.
Well, it's actually more than that. It's because they've had great movies.
That too. Yeah.
I mean, you know, when they had a bad year, and we broke down all the movies that came out that year, they weren't very good.
Yeah.
You know, the best movies were mediocre. This year, they've had amazing movies come out. So
really?
Yeah.
What have been the big ones that come to your mind, though?
Well, Batman is
Iron Man.
Amazing. Iron Man was fantastic.
Well, Batman came out like last night.
I saw it. It's
great. You did see it. Okay.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, it was like 96% Rotten Tomatoes, if that means anything to you.
Okay,
A 3:30 on Friday showing sold out.
I think my...
Well, I know. And they made $18.5 million on just the midnight showing.
I'm holding off on Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes, mm-hmm. just because you know the fanboys are the ones who saw it the first night.
Sure.
You know, and who else could possibly get in?
Well, it did 3 weeks ago at advanced screening.
No, but Rotten Tomatoes doesn't...
SAG members.
...isn't ratings by fans. It's
you're right.
It's ratings by, like, the New York Times and,
you know. That's pretty
good. As well as, though, just... to generic bloggers now.
Well, you can. They have two sets of ratings, but the ratings that they judge by are by the criteria of professional reviewers.
Mm-hmm.
So, good deal.
Okay.
Though I don't always agree with most of the professional critics out there.
You know, I got to say, I am surprised at how consistently I do.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not always. Like Hellboy was fun, but I didn't connect with it.
I saw that as well. You didn't.
Yeah, it was fun.
I thought it was fun.
Yeah,
but it's not like the first one.
But
no,
it jumped. It jumped genres.
Yeah,
and that was a little disconcerting for me. It did it really well, but I mean, it just, you know, suddenly it's elves and, you know, fairies and we had started off with something that was, you know, demons and you know,
don't consider them in the same realm though.
They are loosely, but I thought that it was such a complete jump.
Yeah.
From one to the other, it wasn't like they added in fairies and things like that to the genre. It was that we have now jumped from, you know,
a Cthulhu thing
into, you know, a full fledged fantasy.
Right.
You know,
right.
Where, yeah. That happens to have a demon in it. You know.
For me, I mean, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a little too epic. I guess if that's the best way to put it. It was a little too long, but it was
too long, but to me it was because they kept losing focus over and over. Mm. In fact, they even tried to set up the next movie, which had nothing to do with the storyline we were in the middle of.
Right.
I'm like, why did we just waste 10 minutes?
I'm still looking forward to it.
I mean, I enjoyed it, though. Yeah.
It's good. I'm just saying it loses focus,
but
which
it was
doesn't
funny.
Make it
was
great.
Very funny.
It's fun.
It was in the high 70s on Rotten Tomatoes, and it got...
I would agree with
actually,
that.
Actually, I think it got in 80s now.
Oh, is it in 82? It got great reviews, and it was actually a fine film. I was just slightly disappointed because it jumped... It was a great film. It was very well done.
I hate to reiterate things we've said in prior episodes. I just think this year is going to be... It's going to be hard to top WALL-E.
Oh, you know. Absolutely. But, you know, but Batman...
So you guys liked WALL-E across the board?
Oh, WALL-E was great.
I really like WALL-E. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's one of their best films or anything. But
you didn't probably like a mixed message that it was sending in the sense that this...
No.
Well, it was about, like, anti-consumerism.
No, I don't... I think everyone needs to just freaking calm down on the message.
Oh, really?
Well, it's a product of the times. It's not a big political sign hanging in front of Hollywood. It's a product of the times. We're all worried about the environment. We're all worried about how we deal with the media and all that stuff. And this is a story based off of that. It's not
For me, actually, I think a lot of the people who were riding the environmental message were sort of missing the point. I mean, it's a definite point in the movie, but I think the real point of the movie is apathy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people completely just ignored that aspect of it.
I took away from, like, anti-consumerism, and it just seemed that, or consumer, you know, over-consuming, and it seemed like coming out from a corporation like Disney.
Yeah, Disney,
a little,
Pixar should not be preaching that.
Well, that's the only... I mean, I enjoyed the movie as well, but I kind of started thinking about what that message meant coming from them.
I think you're making a great point, but let's also keep in mind that it's not entirely fair to call it Disney Pixar, okay? Because Pixar is still very independent of Disney. And so
that's true.
And Pixar, even though it makes a lot of money and even though there's a certain level of consumerism, they approach it in a slightly different way than Disney itself does. Disney is much more cookie-cutter consumerism. Mm-hmm.
Did I misunderstand? I thought actually Pixar is much more closely aligned with Disney now.
It is much more closely aligned, but that doesn't mean that the division inside of Disney is run the same way Disney is and run by the same people. I think it's
Pixar
pretty much
is run like I think Pixar still.
But I guess it's the branding of the toys, you know, and the kids' meals, and it's just that. I mean,
did they do that for WALL-E?
Totally.
Because I don't remember any advertising for it.
Oh, you nuts.
I have DVR now, so I skip all that crap.
Well, ads everywhere.
I think it's a good point. But I think also what Don said is more important. I thought the message of the film was not that you shouldn't have things and that you shouldn't, you know, enjoy life. The message of the film was that apathy is bad, that not paying attention to the way the world works is bad. But more importantly, you know, I think that the symbol of this one plant and how delicate it was, representing the world. I think their point was that, you know, the world you have is a delicate world, and you have to take care of it. Mm. You know, that doesn't mean don't have a toy. It doesn't mean, you know, you're not allowed to have toys. You know, you could have a top, and that's it. We're back to Puritanism. I mean, no.
And it also is not a political message. I mean, people keep putting.
Well, I don't know about the. I don't agree with that.
I mean,
Wally
take care of your house.
Wally got slammed by right wing political.
I know.
But, slammed because they're saying it's pushing a right wing environmental agenda, a left wing environmental agenda.
But everybody hangs a shingle like that on everything these days, and people just need to just. It's again a product of its time. It's something we're all thinking about, and this is the type of stories that get birthed in this type of. I mean, I just wrote a script with the same freaking, you know, ideas behind it. Pretty much, I mean, it's a sign of the times. So.
Well, if I may, what's interesting is if you actually look at polls, about 80% of people say that they're concerned about the environment.
Yeah,
you know, so the idea that it's a left-wing message to be concerned about the environment. Is ridiculous. You know, it's just the extreme right-wing pundits that make it seem like that's not the case.
Because even evangelicals who
are... Just speaking my own personal biases, and I'll put that huge disclaimer on there, whenever I hear a pundit slamming Wally for being, you know, this left-wing environmentalism message, I'm kind of thinking that's the pundit that's been bought by the corporatocracy.
Probably.
Like, you know right there who they pay their allegiance to. Because it's not to their own children. You know, just saying.
That's spoiler alerts for everybody.
Wally.
Okay. So should we do some news?
Yes, because the rest of my news is pretty much what I've been doing this week.
Okay.
It kind of fits in. So,
let's cue the music. Wow, I love that music.
Oh, it's better in person.
I know, you never expected to see the organ grinder with a little monkey dancing.
I did not. No.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast it plays too. It's like so fast. But it's done. You know. Right.
All right. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
All right, Peter.
Okay, Steve. Have you guys ever gone down the street and you've seen like these hot pink backpacks that people have?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a new type of hot pink backpack for cows.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go on.
Okay, maybe I'm fudging a little bit here, but okay, basically,
it's one of those gas bags.
In an attempt, there you go. In an attempt to understand the extent of cow flatulence on global warming, scientists in Argentina are strapping plastic bags to the backs of cows to capture their emissions. Argentina has more than 55 million cows, making it the leading producer of beef. In a study, the scientists were surprised to discover that a standard 550-kilogram cow produces more than 800 to 1,000 liters of emissions, including methane, each day.
Right.
Further, methane is 23 times more effective than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere. So basically what these guys decided that they wanted to – the things that they found out was that if they could find a way to reduce the methane from cows, they could maybe reduce 30% of the emissions that Argentina was putting out into the atmosphere.
Wait, what are they doing with the –
What are they doing with the cows? So what
the emissions after they capture.
They're lighting them all with a lighter.
But so the way they figured this out, though, was they put these big, hot, pink backpacks.
Why is it all pink? All I can picture is green fire at night, cattle ranchers delight.
Yeah. And they put a tube into the cow's stomachs, and that's how they were testing this stuff out. But one of the things that they're doing is they're trying different diets. And they found that basically by feeding them different food, they can reduce methane emission by 25%.
Oh, that's not bad.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's actually a lot.
Yeah. It's actually standard feed with Beano.
Yeah, exactly.
actually, it's...
So those cowboy baked beans they were feeding them probably
I've seen a picture of one of the cows with the pack they're talking about on here. That's the picture.
He looks like a Ghostbuster.
Yeah. Love that. No, it looks like a rocket cow.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
Like, if anyone ever attacks Argentina, they're going to launch.
I'm just wondering why it's pink. Capability I don't now. Understand the color choice.
I don't know either. But basically, what they're feeding the cows to reduce emissions is clover and alfalfa.
Hmm.
And if they don't feed them, if they feed them that instead of grain.
You know, that's kind of funny because if I eat alfalfa, I'm actually really dangerous to be around.
You know, but you're not a cow.
That's true.
I've never tried clover, though.
No, you know, we'll just have to try that experiment.
But cows should be grazing on grass anyway. I mean, naturally, they're from what I understand.
I don't know that they actually – grass is not like a big thing that grows naturally out in the world. I mean, like there's – there are weeds and all sorts of stuff that grows out there, but I don't think grass is...
Depends.
Well, I mean, I guess plant-based. Well,
yeah, it depends on where you are.
But, yeah, normal plant-based stuff.
I mean,
yeah.
The American plains had a lot of grass.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot of something, but was it really grass?
Yeah, yeah.
It's grassland.
Not necessarily.
It's there's different types of grass. Different types of grass.
But it's like hay grasses and, you know, tough.
They're called tall grass.
Yeah, it's tough, nasty grass, but it's grass.
It's nasty grass.
Do you have anything, Clint?
I do.
Wow.
I don't know if it's interesting.
He came prepared.
I know.
Well, I did my homework.
He's got like a 2-inch stack of papers.
Yes, I carted over an encyclopedia.
With pictures.
And
porn magazines at the bottom.
Hey.
Oh, sorry.
Well, one quick note. Intel turned 40 years for anyone who's a PC.
Yay.
But this has nothing to do with that. So GM...
This is a side note.
GM's designing futuristic windshields to help older drivers. And the thing is, it's basically a heads-up display that they're developing, and it will...
Yeah, it's nothing like new technology to help old people out with.
Well, the argument was that...
Basically, it's a big, giant magnifying glass that comes down right in front of their face so they can actually see.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a HUD display that can be viewed from any angle. On the windshield, and it would basically, if it's like a foggy road, let's say, it would start to make these like glowing lines around the edge of the road.
What?
If there's a person that's standing or crossing, it would like outline them. Like this is like for night, for example.
That's pretty cool. If it can find it, then why doesn't it just go into autopilot and make sure that they don't steer off the road? I mean, it's found the boundaries.
This is theoretical at this point. This is their goal. But they said the windshield designed specifically for older drivers who have vision problems at a much higher rate than obviously other age groups. Currently, 12.4% of the population is 65 or older. However, by 2030, they said that's going to jump to 20%, or 71.5 million people. And they said basically, you know, older people want to drive just as much as anybody else. They came from a time where everyone drove.
Yes, but they can't.
Well, yeah, exactly. This is supposed to remedy that's problem. So,
yeah.
Does it also have like a horn that when you press it says, run for your lives?
I'm just picturing the onboard computer system. Like, where are you going, Beulah?
But... yeah, I mean, there's other applications. They said, you know, for instance, GPS, sometimes you get confused of which way to go, like which road to turn on.
Yeah.
It would indicate like exactly it would light up kind of the direction of which road, so it would interact with the GPS. So there might be other applications down the road, but I thought it was interesting. I mean, it's for old people, so no one cares, but...
They need a GPS for old people. Turn left.
What?
Turn left.
Who's talking to me?
Turn left. Who's that?
Just one last thing. It combines lasers, infrared sensors, and a camera to take what's happening in the road and enhance it. So that's what it's
freaking says. Lasers. You can do anything.
I know.
Send messages.
Lasers.
Your car will be able to do like LASIK surgery on you soon. Yeah.
And hair removal.
Your eye needs some
and vaginal
with
rejuvenation.
Freaking laser beams attached to their heads.
Subarus with freaking laser beams.
Don?
I did not bring news stories this week,
you can have mine.
But, no, I decided I would bring comic book reviews of some of the comic books that I've been reading lately.
Nice.
So, for my first review, and I can't remember if we've discussed any of these on the air or not, so, obviously, being the big zombie fan that I am, I have to bring up Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm. Great comic.
Has anyone else here read that already?
I've read it. Nope.
Okay. I love this comic. It's exactly what I want from every zombie movie I've ever seen.
Is this a graphic novel at this point, or is it only comic?
There are 9 collections right now.
Oh.
So it's a long-running series.
Oh, okay.
Going for a little while right now. They have soft covers and hard covers that collect multiple of the soft cover collections.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. But long story short, it basically follows, and the plot line at its nucleus and its basic content is not new to the zombie genre, which is actually nice for a lot of us who are big into the zombie thing.
Right.
So it follows the adventures of one man who wakes up in the hospital post-outbreak and everyone's gone and the zombies are out. Right?
Cool.
So at first you're trying to figure out what happened to him, how he got into the hospital. He's in his home neighborhood. He can't find anyone. And when he finally makes contact with someone, he finds out what happened.
Mm.
And from that point, he's on a quest to find his family. And I'm not going to give away a tremendous amount of the series, but I will say eventually he does manage to meet up with a group of survivors.
Cool.
And so what you see over the course of the entirety of the 9 collections that I've read now, because I got addicted, is a deeper exploration of all of the zombie standards mm-hmm. that you've sort of come to expect.
Like they take all the typical stuff and then they kind they of just, dig into it a little
bit. Yeah, they dig into it a little bit more. They they explore it in more depth and detail than any of the movies I've seen.
Do they turn it on its head and kind of change?
They do eventually, but not sort of in the way you expect. Okay. So, for example...
are they shambling or do they run?
They're shamblers in this one. So, for example, he goes to the first big city that he can think of because that's where you're supposed to go for it to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
You find out what happened to the big city.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, a group of survivors try and hole up in a prison penitentiary. And they kind of explore why that's a good idea, why it's a bad idea. And as the series goes on, the focus shifts from being fear of the zombies to fear of other survivors.
Of course. In typical zombie.
That's the basis of the zombie genre.
Right.
But they do it so well, and they do it on a much more sustained level than any of the movies. It's just an ongoing storyline. And so it's written in such a way where it's not intended to end.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep following this one person as he takes whatever steps are needed for him and his group to survive.
So they're still writing them.
They are still writing them, not me. it's black and white. The art style is very simple. The zombies are not made to be, you know, the terrifying 28 Days Later style. It's definitely a throwback to the Night of the Living Dead style zombies.
Okay, cool. 80s.
But they're not made, you can't ignore them either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're definitely a factor in all the comics and they, I like the way he,
and the series
them.
Is called
Walking Dead. Yeah. Give it a shot. Read the first two novels. I always suggest if you're going to try anything up, you have to try the first two compilations.
Yeah.
Okay. Really worth it.
Cool.
Thumbs up.
Yeah. Can I, just because you reminded me of something, can I review something as well?
No.
On perhaps next week, or sacrifice a news story. Hurry up, Peter.
I just want to mention The Road. It's a book by Cormac McCarthy, the guy that did... I can't remember the name of it. But Cormac McCarthy, The Road. This is one of the most terrifying novels I've ever read.
Really?
They're making a movie out of it. Mm. It takes place in the future, in a post-apocalyptic future, where basically nuclear... bombs have killed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing exists mm-hmm. except for ash.
Mm-hmm.
There are no trees that are alive. It's kicked up clouds in the atmosphere, so you can never actually really see the sun. You just see this sort of shape moving through the clouds.
It is flat out total devastation on Earth.
Total devastation. And this follows basically a man and his son as they're traveling on the road looking for some place that's safer. And what is terrifying about this is because there's literally nothing. Nothing can grow. Any survivors that are out there are survivors because they're eating people.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
And so it is terrifying. I mean, it's just the stuff that he writes about and that you see in this.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, right now I'm just getting chills just even
so that's worst case scenario, basically.
Oh, it is dark.
Well, it's funny. People who've heard our zombie episode in the past know that one of the themes for me about zombies that I find so terrifying is the idea of consumption, right? Something that wants to devour you. And
yet in a kind of a vampire-y where it's kind of sexy.
Yeah. Vampires, they sex it up. It's the whole, like, you know, it's not consuming you, it's devouring you, you know,
mm-hmm.
With the mindlessness of the zombie. It's mm-hmm. fine. But that book sounds especially interesting for that.
It's great. I highly recommend it to everyone.
And it's called, again,
The Road, by Cormac McCarthy.
So I have a second one, but we'll...
I would like to review a board game.
Okay.
Now, we only played it once, so I just want to talk about our gameplay of it. We played last week... some point last week, we played Age of Empires 3, the board game.
Oh, wow.
It was a lot.
That's been out for a little while, right?
It's been out for a little while, and I don't know. People haven't really been talking about it. I mean, it pops up on Board Game Geek, and people give it good reviews, but no one's been, like, talking about it, maybe mm-hmm. just because it's another historical game, and it's just mm-hmm. not getting people revved up. If it plays as well as it did... the first time we played, again, I would put it up there near my top games of all time.
Oh, wow.
Really?
I thought it was awesome.
What was the time? How long did it take a game?
It took 2 hours.
Oh, not bad.
To complete. I think we could have done it in 90 minutes if we knew how to play.
Mm-hmm.
We also played with the maximum amount of people, 5. I think you can fit one more one more player in, but it's not recommended even by the people. They give you chips to do it, but they think they say, listen, you're pushing the rule set here. But so we played with five people, and it's a great game. I thought it's a Euro game, has Euro game mechanics, but I thought all the Euro game mechanics...
So that means simple mechanics, easy to grasp.
Meaning, yeah, but it's also... The mechanics, I think, usually in those games are developed before the theme, and sometimes they kind of slap a theme on.
Yeah.
In this game, I felt that all the game mechanics worked with the theme, so I actually felt like I was doing what I was supposed to be doing in the real world. Like, it simulated in abstract form some things that I thought fit to the theme, you know? And
is it sort of a nation building game? What is the action you're doing?
I'm wondering if it's similar to the PC game.
Well, okay, the PC game is a real time strategy slash.
It's an RTS, but.
Yeah, but it's also kind of a SimCity culture building, right? On top of it.
A little bit. I mean, all RTS games revolve around building some kind of empire.
Right, true. So, it's like that. This
or base
is
or something.
Pulled further back by a lot. So you have the entire East Coast of the Americas, the New World, there, each divided into territories. And each territory that allows a certain type of resource to be collected if you have enough people who've explored and colonized it. After you've either kind of taken over or integrated in the people of indigenous... nations that are there.
Integrated.
So wow. What you do is everyone takes turns.
Are there actually tokens to represent the blankets you give them?
Yeah. No, but it's... But you kind of...
Oh, that's fair.
There is kind of. What happens is you have... Each person plays a country that is exploring the new world. And you have... you have these kind of... population tokens that you kind of like Kalis, where you place on a board in order, and that represents the resources that you're putting toward different areas. So you might put one in exploration, you might put one in the docks, which are shipping colonists, you might put one in merchant in the merchant area, but you can also specialize in, so you might actually buy soldiers. And so you can send soldiers over when in your discovery and plunder the area and collect more money out of the area if you decide to do it that way. So there is ways of doing that. And then but the cool thing about it is the game's divided into three ages. And so there's a technology progression that happens as you go. But what also happens, and this just happens within the game, is the game type slowly starts evolving, because first age is really a race of discovery to see how many people you can land on there, how many people you can ship over there and collect and strip some of the resources.
Right.
But then it becomes a slow evolution to... I need to put people over into other people's territories, and they maybe start a little revolution and get some soldiers over there and take it over.
Right.
And then, unlike a lot of Euro games, there's a lot of conflict in this. So wars start happening, battles start happening,
that's
and then it starts...
Between each other.
Between each other. In other words, all sorts of nations might have populations in these territories and live fine. I mean, it happened all the time. There's French and Spanish all working together and trading resources.
Right.
But at some point, enough soldiers will end up in a certain area, and they will push the French out.
Sure.
They want more power. Then it becomes their territory. And when that starts happening, it starts getting a little mean, and people were starting to kind of...
Uh-oh.
So, yeah, wait, you said there is a tech tree, then. There is an advancement.
Well, as you move through the ages, you can invest in some of the... Yeah, these tokens, which give you superpowers, essentially, and which allow you maybe to get more soldiers or turn people into militia.
I don't know what it is, but I'm all about the tech tree. I love games.
It sounds very similar to...
Well, this is a little more abstract than, like, a real-time strategy tech tree. The ages, you dump the age one tiles, and then then move into age two and use those tiles. And sure. So you start then
but
buying
the Age of Empire games
those
have always had the ages. That was their shtick.
Yeah. You know? So I thought it worked really well. I even got my ass whooped and I still had fun.
Oh.
And that's, I think, a sign of a good...
So two thumbs up from the two geeks who played it?
Yeah. And
two
I think even Tracy, Peter's wife, played it. And
for the first time, she didn't win?
Yeah, that's right. She's pretty good.
She is the freaking Terminator yeah. of board games, this woman.
And what's hysterical...
And she always goes, tee-hee,
she was second, yeah. I think, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was second. Every time she plays a game, though, she wins. And then we come back to play it again. She goes, I've never played this before. We go, yes, you have. You beat us last time. I don't think I've played this before.
It's the sign of a good hustler. You know, I've never played pool before. Is $50 enough to bet?
Yeah.
You know?
But here's the funny thing is the person who won was the sneaky... quiet one. Like Eris won, right?
Yeah, we just didn't see him coming.
We started a little battling between us and start pushing each other. Like Peter and I were pushing each other around on the map and it became a little personal because we were invading.
So that's
and
perfect.
Then
he
while
just
we were
let you
doing
guys
that,
do that, yeah.
While we were doing that, Eris just kept shipping people over and just made it so that you couldn't take over his territories. And we're like, oh, damn.
Nice. Good
yeah.
stuff.
So anyway, and cool. There's all sorts of great strategies. You don't have to do it one way.
Beautiful. So what was the name of that again?
It's called Age of Empires 3, the board game.
And you can get that at your local gaming store?
You can. You might be able to, but you can also get it online. There's
What's
all sorts
the,
of
Yeah,
that.
But come on,
MSRP
guys. Let's try and support some of our brick-and-mortar stores out there, right?
It is spendy. I think it's like $50 or $60.
Yeah. It's a big box, right?
It's a big box.
Yeah.
It's a fun
beautiful
game,
board, all sorts of pieces. Mm-hmm. Anyway, worth buying.
Cool. Conversation for another time, but I would like to encourage people to go support their local brick-and-mortar stores.
I would also
Yeah, and I wish the local brick-and-mortar stores would clean their shit.
Well, there's a new one in Pasadena, that Game Empire. It's pretty nice.
I haven't been, yeah.
I haven't been there yet. I didn't know
it's
about
nice.
That.
We'll go. Yeah, we'll go. It's new.
Right? It's newer.
Newer.
Yeah.
We should get in like a new store owner. And like talk to them about what
yeah, why they're filthy.
You guys, yeah, you should talk.
Yeah,
board game
we
shop
do
owners.
That. Peter.
Okay, so basically, stripped to the waist, mm-hmm. wearing towels around their shoulders and headphones, playing the lulling sound of a moving train to drown out the baying crowd. The men played for 4 minutes of chess. Then. Off came the reading glasses, and on went the gloves and the mouth guards. And for 3 minutes, they beat each other up, and then the bell went off, and the chessboard was back in the ring. And they picked up the gentleman game where it left off. Yes, the new sport of chess boxing.
It would be much more entertaining for me if they actually had to leave the gloves on while they played.
Yeah.
Because they'd waste the whole time trying to pick up the pieces.
Basically, yeah, it's exactly what I just said. And they say that the hard part is that you're out of breath and you have to keep your wits about you when you go back. And if you're the first person who has to make your move after the boxing round, it's where you can really mess up because it's hard to
you're
think. You've just been
clearly.
Beaten to a pulp.
I mean, are these chess players by nature or boxers?
They're both. They're chess players
and
boxers.
I think if you're playing
boxers.
Chess, you're a chess player.
Yeah. Well, but no, but they.
But I
they,
mean, are
I
they
think
chess
if you're
player
boxing,
types?
You're a boxer.
Or
well,
are they
well, no,
suited for boxing?
Because you have to do both. Because a chess boxing match consists of 6 rounds of chess and 5 in the ring, but it can end suddenly in a knockout or a checkmate.
What the?
So basically, what they've tried to do is they've tried to say, okay, we want to take something that you really have to be able to think to win, and we want to take something where you really have to be able to fight. To win and see,
Let's
you know,
see
how they combine.
Who said this? Who's they?
you know, I mean, it's like if you
the National Chess Boxing League.
Oh.
Because the chances are, look, let's put it this way. The chances are you're not going to win chess the first round that you play in this, you know, in the first
right,
4 minutes or whatever it is. So, you know, you're going to go into the ring, and if you can't box when you get in the ring, it's over.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I understand, but I'm wondering if it was chess players that were like, oh, we need to jazz this up somehow.
Look.
Or was it boxers that were like, well, I really like, you know, chess and
people being stupid.
I think it was some really smart boxers and some really tough chess players.
This did occur in Germany, didn't it?
It is Germany.
Yeah.
Oh.
It just seems
Ball
so German
that,
to me,
the
and
director,
I can't explain
Ball,
why.
Or whatever his name is.
But it does kind of bring up the idea of, like, what other weird things could you combine?
So we can't see this in the States. Is that what you're...
I don't know. I didn't. You have to do some research and find out. You know, you could maybe start
check that out.
Los Angeles.
Geek boxing. I think, I don't know if it was on Spike or Tech TV where they had boxers and then they would pull them out and they had to answer geek trivia and then they'd go back and box and then answer geek trivia. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Interesting. Do you have anything else?
I have something short, if you guys...
Needs to be short.
It's very short. So... it's just that more people are trying to add in biomimicry to architecture and design.
That's disgusting.
So, which is, well, if for people that don't know, it's just when, you know, it's studying nature and then pretty much imitating that in a process to solve like human problems. And one of them, of course, architecture. And there's this one that basically has these like flat, like if you can see, I know this is not good for radio, but
oh my god,
they're little like leaf porous leaves type things that that are on the outside of a building and will take in rain, water, and moisture, and then regulate the building's temperature.
Wow,
so, yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So, and that's kind of something I think we're going to see more of as the years progress, is kind of combining what we see in nature, what works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially with when you lean more towards the ecological, it just seems all of them are green solutions in general.
Yes.
You know? Well, not only that, I mean, you have a planet that's spent, you know, millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and billions of years getting to where it is and working. Mm-hmm. So why don't we use some of the technology that has taken billions of years
to develop? Why reinvent the wheel, so to speak?
Yeah, and look and say, wait, you know what? Animals and plants regulate their own heat. How are they doing that?
Sure.
And just embracing, I mean, you know, studying what has been developed naturally. It's a great idea.
But it says the skin behaves like a membrane, which serves as a connection between the exterior and interior of the habitat. The skin can be considered as a leaf surface. And there's cellular openings that basically has a gaseous exchange like that.
I'm sure that wasn't cheap.
No, I mean, this is something that's just being implemented now, and I think in China, which, of course, they need it. So.
Yeah.
But, the air and the wind would be channeled through, along with water. And
that's pretty cool. Yeah,
so. This is our new coal-powered air conditioning unit in China.
Clean coal.
Yeah. All right.
Let me do my second review real quick.
Okay.
I've been also reading Fable, which is another one I don't remember if we've ever talked about on here. Right now, I believe
not
Fable,
based off of the
video game.
Video game.
In fact,
it was a hit, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
But Fable, the comic book series, is currently up to their 9th graphic novel collection as well, and follows the events of I can't remember the name of the town. Fabletown, I think.
Fableton,
something like that. But the basic premise is that the land of fairy tales has been invaded by an enemy called the Adversary or the Other, something like that, and driven out a lot of the fairy tale characters. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have died, but a lot of them have basically taken up residence in Fabletown, which is hidden in the center of New York City. It looks like a block just like any other, and all of the people there have to keep their heads down. Mm-hmm. But all of them are in fact characters from famous fairy tales.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, there's another settlement outside of the city called The Farm, where all of the non-human fairy tale characters have to live.
Mm-hmm.
So the two of them have to kind of coexist, supporting each other. And the basic storyline of the series is the actions these people are trying to take to retake their homeland.
And it's in the middle of New York City?
Middle of New York City, and has been since like the 1600s, I think.
And you said there's a farm, but out like in the upstate
New York? It's like in upstate New York, yeah.
So New Yorkers don't really know that they're there.
They know the town. They know that physically the street is there. People occasionally go and shop in the bakery, you know, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of stay away.
But
from
they
it.
Don't know who those people are.
Oh, okay.
They're just trying to hide as normal people.
And you said the farm type. The non-humans are outside the city. Do they get along? I know they said they kind of have to coexist because they're all different.
They do get along, but one of the big kind of political storylines is the fact that the people who live on the farm resent having to stay in that one place all of their lives and never be able to travel and never allow themselves to be seen. The people in the city have the responsibility to try and maintain the farm and make sure it gets what it needs. And the farm, in the meantime, feels like a prison to a lot of the people who live there. Yeah. So one of the storylines there is a bit of a revolt from the farm, not to give anything away. But despite the fairy tale background of it, the storylines are actually very mature. The first story arc is a murder mystery, and deals with some very mature storylines over the course of the series, while maintaining kind of a high fantasy sensibility, if not always content.
Hmm.
You know, so for example, one of the things that all these fairy tales have in common is immortality. As long as their stories are told and people out there have some sort of faith or connection to them, they can't die.
The Tinkerbell conundrum.
Exactly. So they have this whole storyline where, like, I forget who it is. I want to say, like, you know, say Goldilocks, for example, has been upended into headfirst down a well for the past 30 years. She can't die because people still believe in her, but she's underwater.
Jesus.
You know, and shit like that. It's really nice stuff.
Yeah, it sounds nice.
Yeah. But it's not what you expect. The first collection is not necessarily the best example of the series. It gets much more mature and deep from that point on, I think. But another thumbs up. Very different from Walking Dead. Probably not the same core audience. But give it a try. I think it's very worthwhile.
All right. Excellent.
Let's do our subject.
Let's. All right, so this week we're going to talk about some role-playing stuff. Actually, you could probably use this for writing or whatever. But, you know, one of our ideas was maybe talk about, maybe this being part of a series, talking about plot ideas, role-playing seeds of different types. And this week we're going to do ice worlds, snow fields,
snow, ice, cold,
that type of thing,
polar bears, and
role playing,
penguins,
carnivorous penguins.
So anyway,
carnivorous penguins with clown makeup on.
Oh,
So let's talk about ice worlds and ice. I don't know what they call territories.
Mm-hmm. Did you have one particular setting in mind when you thought?
No, actually, I went through all sorts of settings. I think that a lot of people are role playing in the fantasy worlds, and I think ice worlds are probably less frequently used in role playing sessions.
I think they're generally perceived as being less attractive because they're less civilized. You know, you don't have a basis to work from. It's going to be very tribal. And then you don't have sort of the jungle feeling of, you know, that dark, lush place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just vast, barren emptinesses.
Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things here that I think are pluses. So let's talk about why you would set your game, or even just your current storyline, why you would move it to such a place. One, I think, is, and this is the most simple one of them all, is that there's new, interesting hardships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's
environmental
hardships. There's also stuff that just hasn't been introduced into your campaign already. You know, I mean, how many jungle, you know, things are you going to do over and over and over again?
Mm-hmm.
Whole new set of hardships. The other one is isolation.
Right.
You mentioned that.
It's always barren, it would seem.
There's always a sense of isolation in these type of environments, and I think that you can use that as an advantage. Those type of themes can influence the way your players feel about going to these type of places. The other thing is it introduces a whole new set of non-player characters or even player characters to your campaign that you might not think of. Because of all these factors, they might generate some type of character personality flaws or pluses or physical flaws or, you know, advantages that you hadn't thought of if you were just doing hobbits in, you know, a field.
You know, to kind of say what you're saying but expand on it, make it a wider statement that encompasses everything you've said, what it does, for me at least, is when you go into like a fantasy realm, fantasy is so well trodden. You know, fairies and goblins, that it's hard to write something that or create a story that doesn't feel somehow derivative. But this is a field that because it has some difficulties that you have to overcome to make it interesting, it allows you to be really inventive and really creative. So it's really fun. It's a fun world to take on because you can take things, you can find a way of twisting it and taking it in a way that someone would never have imagined. You can take the obstacles that you're running into, like, you know, one of the reasons that we like something like a forest is because you want the sense of surprise and danger. Something could pop up out of the middle of nowhere, as opposed to, like, if you're out on like some tundra plains, you kind of, anything that's coming, you're going to see coming. Okay.
Not if you're on a sheet of frozen lakes.
There you go. There you go. Something could come up from the ground, or, you know, if there's ice storms, you know, there could be something.
You could be a mountainous type.
It's hard for me not to think of it in the same breath of, say, a desert campaign. where you would have these oases of life where you can sustain your people or your tribe or you for a length of time with these vast empty, you know, deadly regions between.
But, you know, there's another way of looking at that. There's no reason why your space campaign cannot crash land on a frozen planet where it's just abundant of life and people thrive in that type of area. And so it would be interesting to explore what is it that makes these people thrive. Why would I normally feel completely isolated and in trouble that I'm now in a place where these people are living perfectly fine, which is also interesting.
For me, that's a little more attractive. And I know a lot of our listeners out there are world builders. Mm-hmm. They like the idea of having to come up with, you know, an environment of their own. The first thing that comes to my mind is what sort of psychology would arise from living on a frozen planet.
Exactly.
The first thing that comes to my mind, for example, is like the gift of heat. Right?
Right?
Your heat, your body heat is the symbol of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to lose that heat, like, that must be terrifying on some level.
Yeah, I mean, is it,
you know,
is,
to share
flame,
that heat with another?
Is a flame more important in a symbolic way to these people than somebody who just lives, you know, anywhere else on a planet? Do they worship something like that?
And it actually, in some ways, offers the opposite dangers from a desert campaign, where, you know, the quest for water is no longer really a factor.
Right. Know? Unless we're not talking about humanoids that we know, and they don't need fire. They could be cold-blooded or...
Wouldn't it be great that if you arrived and warm-blooded beings were feared by them?
Just their touch can hurt you.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just reading a book called Consider Phlebas by Ian Banks. And in it, there's this really fascinating moment where this guy's on an ice world, and there are insects that crawl around, and he goes to pick one up because it's interesting, and the girl he's with is like, oh no, don't. And it's, the instant he touches it, it dies, because it's designed to live on an ice world. He burns it by touching it.
Right, yeah.
Right.
You know?
Right.
The other thing I think is interesting is these type of places are always in far off places, even in things like Middle Earths and that type of thing, and they always are talked about in rumors, and people always say, oh, the people up north, the lands up north. And so they're always destinations that you can use as being mysterious because they're filled with, no one ever goes up there and no one ever comes back. So what can you do in your taverns down in jungle, in grassland territory that will inspire the players to want to go to such a horrible place? You know, what can you devise that would be hidden up in these Arctic territories that they could get them to travel all this way and move into such a dangerous area? I think it's a great opportunity to just lure them. You know, this is a place no one goes. No one will be caught dead going up there, and yet your players are going to try it.
Let's also talk about a couple of the reasons why it could be an ice world. So, for example,
why does it exist in the universe?
Why does it exist in the universe?
Like a Europa moon or something?
Well, in a sci-fi campaign, it might be a whole planet.
It might be a whole planet, right.
Yeah.
But if you look at, like, for example, The Road, which I was just talking about, they are actually in a nuclear winter.
Interesting.
And so, you know, that's a world that you could go into, and it would be a real fascinating world where you spend basically your life trying to find... Where you spend basically your life trying to find canned food. You know, that's the only thing you can eat.
Right.
And the people that you run into, you know, one of the images that they have in the book The Road that was really fascinating is they're camped out on the side of the road, the man and his boy. And, you know, his only thing that he's trying to do is protect his son. That's all he cares about. And all of a sudden he realizes that there's a convoy coming down the road. And he can hear this bus coming. And so they hide, and they're just laying there, and you start to see these people coming out of the sort of fog.
Ash snow.
You know, the ash snow, right. And what you see at first is just these people who are wrapped in, you know, clothes but have masks on their faces because it's all
ash.
Gas masks, because there's ash everywhere and you don't want to breathe it. And they're all just holding clubs as they walk out into the snow.
Sure.
And then you see the next group of people who don't really have clothes on, and they're slaves.
Mm.
And they're got chains yoked to them, and they're pulling this old truck.
Mm.
And up on top of the truck there are these men who are sitting there with shotguns and rifles who are, you know.
So here, the winter, because it's changed so quickly on them, society has gone just completely.
Well, survival mode.
Which yeah, it's gone Mad Max, but in a winter.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, that's what I guess the game Fallout's kind of similar in that setting too, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, except I don't think they do nuclear winter. I think it's
not a nuclear winter.
I'm not positive.
I thought it was.
Yeah. It might be, but I don't remember. I think it's everything's irradiated, but I don't think everything's snow. I think
So it actually is. It's not. It's actually snowing all the time. Not just snowing ash.
It's snow or rain. It's all sorts of stuff. There's ash everywhere. Yeah. When they're walking down the road, they're pushing carts through ash, leaving tracks through the ash.
I think the big thing for me for an Arctic campaign is not so much. I have played in an Arctic campaign as a player. Okay. And I actually found it a little tedious for me because the basics of the campaign was daily survival, right? Yeah. Which was slogging across a tundra. And I think it was a mistake. You know,
well, I think that's a role-playing mistake.
Yeah, it could just be.
I mean, you know.
It was, I think, on the Game Master's part.
Yeah, that's what
focus was a mistake.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you know? That could happen on any of these environments is if you're making, you know, the part of the game tedious by a nitpicking on non-story.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's really non-story, really.
And let's talk about just because it's a winter world doesn't mean it's a flat tundra. It could be cities. There could be cities that are desolated. It can be mountains.
Yeah, it could be.
You know, you could have underground snow bunkers that people have carved out their own underground cities.
Yeah, don't think of it as just, you know, what you see in Alaska.
No.
I mean, that's your
that's the mistake.
Well, I guess, what would you consider, like, the dwarven caves in Lord of the Rings, for example, were built under mountains. And those, but would that still fall into that?
Yeah, I mean, make them ice caves.
All you do is make them ice caves.
Yeah. And, you know.
But you could have monsters that tunnel through the ice.
Offer variety and try not to harp on the same point. You know, yes, it's ice. Yes, it's difficult to traverse. Bring that up once in a while. Let people, you know, kind of just show how they do that. But don't harp on it forever because you'll bore your players. And that's true of everything.
Or maybe it, you know, discuss how it's taking toll on the character and shave the character's stats off a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like they are going to have to now suffer for being in this environment. So if they were, you know, if they're walking around as level, you know, 30 people, maybe you shave off some of those stats because you don't have to describe every day why they're suffering, but they'll know it because they're going to be looking at their character sheet going, damn, I used to have a constitution of blah, blah. Now it's down to so-and-so. And it's going to be that way until we get off this ice shield or out of these ice caves.
Yeah. Well, another thing to pull up then would be a Game of Thrones, you know, which a Game of Thrones, which takes place in a world that that winter is coming, that they have summers that last 4 years long. And when winter comes, it lasts 4 years long, you know, or you could do something, a world that is an ice world in the sense that it has very long winters, but it still has summers. They're just brief. You know,
the thing for me that I would find most attractive, just for myself, is and I find I'm thinking exactly the same thing for a desert campaign, is ice and snow. Like the most fundamental aspect of it is that it covers things, right? So think in terms of the world of mystery to be uncovered, right? And that's just harping on exactly what you said a minute ago: cities, ice caves, ruins, all that sort of thing. But think about it on a more fundamental level too. For me, the part of the fun for playing on an ice planet would be discovering it wasn't always this way. If it wasn't always this way, what happened? Right. And can we fix it? And if that was my campaign, like restoring life to the world, that would be very interesting to me.
Well, I wanted to kind of move into, I mean, we can describe the type of things that you would have to go through, you know, avalanches and all that stuff, but just look it up. Moving into like the types of PCs and non-player characters, this kind of moves in the same direction you're talking about. Do these people want to be there? Do they thrive there or not? And why are they still there?
Right.
Are they cursed? Is it a king who's cursed to live in an ice world, and everything he touches turns to, you know, to ice, and he has to rule a kingdom of ice until something happens? Is it an entire kingdom that's been frozen, and there's something that your player characters can do? Is it an ice? Do you crash land on an ice planet? Find an ancient civilization that's completely been devastated because it's frozen, and you uncover the mysteries of why it's that way, and the only way for you to get off the planet is to solve this mystery. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, trying to figure out why the non-player characters that you're going to be coming across or the civilization is even there, whether they wanted to or not, is another interesting, is it something to think about, you know, and base the character is around that.
Yeah.
Is everybody isolated, and is every player you come up to, are they all isolationists, and they can't stand people because they live in snowy, weird... Well,
I mean, something to consider, for just underscoring your point, mm-hmm. Every civilization center of every type exists, usually because there's a food source nearby. If there isn't, like, say, Las Vegas, there's a very good reason why it's there, mm-hmm. and it's supported by external sources for a reason. So that's just something to think about when you're designing your cities and your Tundrascape.
Yeah,
and imagine a city that's based around the fact that it's on a natural hot springs. You know,
yeah, exactly.
It's called Reykjavik.
Well, also, but, you know, also why...
Reykjavik is built on a natural hot spring.
Oh. No, I got it.
This is something that a lot of people just don't do. Why your non-player characters do what they do. And, you know, if you live in such a harsh environment, this could be a big part of the personality. If you're... You know, ask each one of your major non-player characters if they could have one wish... What would it be? Mm-hmm. Would it be to get the hell out of there? Maybe it isn't. Yeah. But that's going to define
maybe
who they are.
Maybe you combine two things where you need, you know, your players need to get off. But in to do so, you have to disrupt these people's lives. And they don't want their place changed. But
exactly.
You have to change it to get off the planet.
Exactly.
And now you have that moral kind of question.
Exactly.
You know, another idea is that maybe... just because a world is... I mean, we kind of mentioned this, but let's... broaden it a little bit. Maybe just because a world is an ice world doesn't mean that it's barren. I mean, there are trees, there's animals, you know, but what type of animals would live on this place? Animals with, you know, like you see at the North Pole, with very thick fur. You could have giant herds of things. There could be trees that are flourishing, you know, but or
some kind of vegetation that's adapted to that climate.
But it's cold out, you know, instead of being what we would normally expect.
Now, also, there's no reason why your player characters cannot be from or be completely entrenched in these type of games.
Yep.
And I think you should also think about ways of designing races, aliens, player characters that came from or are products of this type of environment.
Exactly.
Snow dwarves.
Yeah.
Why can't there be snow dwarves? I'm sure there exist in some book, novel, or whatever.
If you live in a low protein area where food is scarce, you're going to be smaller.
Yeah, I have I built a little dwarf here.
Yeah, which I find so funny because in a lot of like D&D settings, the Arctic living people are usually tall, blonde, and incredibly huge and buff.
Yeah, no, my guy is
these
are dwarves who search the Arctic mountains for precious metals like silver and gold, not ores and that type of stuff, metal ores. And they carve out little shallow caves, and then they build little wood huts in front of them, so they're kind of half cave, half log cabins.
Yeah.
They have allies. They're allies with snow yetis. So they
why not?
Sure.
They have temperature tolerance. They can tolerate down to 15 degrees. They have thick skin and lots of hair, furry little guys. Which also gives them a natural defense. Their color blindness, because they've been on the white Arctic snow for so long, that they can't distinguish color. They're fat and they're greedy.
Why not?
Would you add the last one in for kicks?
That's one of the things you have to incorporate, though. Again, if you're in
a
region where you live by scrounging, with low resource levels, it's going to affect your morality in a lot of ways. If somebody can't contribute to your society, think about it. All of the resources you use to maintain a life that isn't contributing to the whole, you're more likely to cut them loose in one way or another.
I also came up with some other ideas that you might have for different aliens or races. Third eyelids for snow blindness, a little thing that would come over or protect
like a cat's
you from
tympanic
like,
membrane.
Yeah, exactly. Fur camouflage, where you're kind of more white, kind of just blend of the snow, so you're albino maybe even. Increased consumption, you have to eat more often to gain energy. You're constantly having to eat. You have to, even same thing, like maybe something type of maintenance where you have to sleep frozen, like in a frozen
nice.
Tomb or something. I have some superpowers. I mean, hey, come on, superhero game. There's all sorts of superheroes that have come out of ice, morph into wolves and yetis and that type of thing. Ice elementals.
The environment also, like thinking, you just started me thinking about other races to set there, of course. Damn you. But immediately, one of the things that came to my mind would be, for example, ice elves. Why not? Right?
That was going to be the first thing I built. Okay. That I decided to go dwarf.
No, it's a wise choice. But imagine, you know, these ice cities built like Superman's Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah, beautiful, intricate ice cities.
And so immediately what I started thinking was, how would they eat? And so since you have these ice cities growing out of the ice, there's no reason why they couldn't leave holes underneath
fish.
To access fish and seaweed. And now if they have increased access to food resources, now we have a setup for haves and have-nots. Mm-hmm. Now we actually have a social structure where we could have human tribes living around the ice elves, completely dependent on the ice elves for food, trading whatever the ice elves want. In essence, becoming their labor class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just... There
and remember,
are ways to layer this.
These exact things translate to sci-fi campaigns. Instead of exact same thing, but instead of calling them elves, to throw out a weird name on them, same exact same.
The Iloquois. Well, they could be using technology, too, to
exactly.
facilitate
and,
some of this.
Eloy and Murlocs.
And, you know, there's no reason why you can't make Wolverine-type characters with ice claws that come out for your superhero guys. I mean... You know,
other than the fact that it would be really silly.
I broke my
claws on your leather jacket. God,
yeah, but if you spear somebody
armor.
With ice claws and they snap out, you just create new ones.
How much ice do you carry around in your arm?
Lots.
You could
you freeze it.
You can
you drink water and then freeze it.
Imagine a whole race that hibernates through the coldest part of the winter. You know, so you come on a city and there's
they're
nobody there. Or they're all asleep.
Right?
That's very cool.
Or, you know, imagine we typically think of dragons as something that wouldn't be here, but, you know, a very furry dragon. You
again,
know, could
for
look
our zombie campaign enthusiasts,
fire on fire,
the new wave of zombie survival is to head north into frozen areas because the zombies freeze on the way towards you.
But there's 20 days of night there.
Oh, there is that, too.
Oh, boy.
You got away from the zombies. Now there are vampires everywhere.
I did come up. I have a couple plot seeds. But the other thing, just to think about, there's no reason why your Pulp Fiction campaign cannot fly up into the north and go searching for the frozen tears of blah-de-blah. And, you know, that's, you know.
Or do a thing like, you know, we've seen this in X-Files and the movie The Thing. You know, they're trapped in a frozen environment.
That's awesome. I love that.
Which is awesome. And then you have your characters very confined.
Yeah, horror games set in that. It's the new trapped in outer space, except you don't even have to do it as a sci-fi.
Right.
These people are trapped. There is nowhere they are going to go. It's a wall. It's a great freaking idea. Super isolation. There's nothing you can do to get... And you should... That's when you should push the isolation and the fact that you cannot survive out there. There's no type of equipment that's going to get you to be able to walk 2,000 miles for help. That's freaky. That is extremely freaky.
Slight tangent. Did any of you hear that news article like 2 weeks ago about the Arctic Way Station that ordered 50,000 condoms?
Oh, yeah. I heard that. Yep.
It's like for 15 people.
I think it was on the Colbert Report or something. They might have mentioned it.
Yeah,
but,
like Daily Show, I think.
Yeah, one of those. It was pretty funny.
Do?
That was pretty much the
as
response.
They said,
when
on our free time, we basically, we have sex. So.
A couple other ideas for that can fit this in. There's no reason why you can't have a great Ice Age game. your tribe is your food is on the move, and you're moving across the ice, following your food as you're going more and more south. You're figuring out all these crazy new 10,000 things.
10,000 PC, so and then a jungle warning, pops up out of nowhere.
One warning, one warning about that. I find players usually are not terribly attracted to campaigns where the goal is sustenance. Like, maintaining the status quo on that level is usually not terribly exciting to people.
No, no, no. Unless you use that as a your beginning campaign to get you to move, and then when you discover something, that becomes the interesting
part. Don't just
think
in terms of sitting in one place with that. You need to have something set in the future for that.
The other thing is, there's no reason why your spies and super secret agents have to keep flying to tropical areas.
Mm.
For Your Eyes Only, and what was that? A Die Another Day. They went to Arctic places.
Still waiting for my apology for that last one.
Perfect place to have bobsled chase scenes, ski chase scenes, all sorts of great adventures can happen. Mm-hmm. Snowmobile with machine guns on there. Come on, people. We don't have to have bikinis in every adventure.
Nuclear submarine.
They can have bikinis, too.
Nuclear submarine gets trapped up by the North Pole.
Exactly.
How do you get it out? How do you save
it? Let's not forget, you don't need to be in Gotham City to have penguins with rockets strapped to their backs.
Well, let's talk about the Golden Compass. I mean, the Golden Compass takes polar bears, and they're talking polar bears that wear armor, and in the books, at least. Let's not talk about the movie. In the books, it was pretty awesome.
Because it's not sounding awesome right now.
Right.
I have to admit, I was not grabbed by their Arctic setting.
Did you read the book?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, the book was interesting. It was really...
Well, it must have been forgotten. Well, I shouldn't say that.
No, the book is pretty...
Been in Hollywood that long.
The book is pretty highly acclaimed. The movie was not very
good. I knew that. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
So,
yeah.
But you can really go crazy. You can take, talking reindeer.
And remember, there's also Tauntauns.
The quest for Santa's workshop.
Sci-fi, Tauntauns. All that type of stuff.
Listen, you could do Santa's workshop with zombies in the North Pole, and it would be interesting.
And then to survive, you have to open up one of the reindeers and sleep inside of it.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. They smell bad on the outside.
Whenever you start an Arctic campaign, it's like people are just looking for an excuse to slit open their riding animal and climb inside.
Well, they're inspired by their childhood.
Yeah.
So what they don't realize, though, is at some point you got to climb back out of it, and then you're wet, and then you're really screwed.
Yeah.
Also, for
your sci-fi settings, this is a great opportunity to come up with some pretty cool sci-fi gear for your people. Even if it is survival, you got to have a couple avalanches and stuff. Sure, you don't want to, have to dwell on them surviving all the time, but an avalanche here or there is pretty exciting. So come up with, technologies that
Armor.
Yeah, power armor or, those avalanche bubbles that, you pull and you get into, this giant bubble and you just tumble down the hill. I mean, that type of stuff I think actually exists now.
Yeah.
In a screenplay that I just worked on, an adaptation on a book, this guy during World War II was traveling across the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
And he came across a what's called a sluice. And a sluice is an area that's had a lot of avalanches and has polished the whole mountainside into one big piece of ice.
Right. It's like glass.
And they had to cross this. Mm. And as they were crossing it, and they were doing fine. They were making their way across. But as they were crossing it, a couple guys fell. And they literally slid down this thing. When you're sliding down ice, you're getting sliced up, first of all. Okay. Yeah. And when they got to the bottom, they went off like a 50-foot drop. And there were like three of the guys. Now, that's not necessarily going to kill you. You're landing in snow. But, I mean, that's a pretty interesting thing to have happen. You going a half mile, a mile down this mountain on ice.
Yeah.
So
that's where the environment really comes into play, I think.
Yeah.
And there's also a reason why your environmental suit can't be a countdown clock. You're stuck on a planet. You've got 2 days. Use the countdown clock as the motivation to make your characters move faster.
That's a good idea.
Ticking clock. Tick, 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 tick. You are going to run out of heat. This thing is going
to
keep
you... Or it's like sliders where they're stuck on there for some amount of time and they have to get to... point B, where the rift opens up.
Exactly. Anyway, does anybody have any other... I've got, some plot ideas. An entire army has been frozen in ice for hundreds of years, and it's about time they've been awoken.
It's about time. Was it Mummy 4?
Yeah, it's Mummy 4. I mentioned some of these throughout.
But like already. going with the sub, you can have an old ship, you know, when they're exploring up north, get stuck in the ice and have a hole. Yeah. And then, I mean, that's how Dracula starts, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
I mean, a bit, you know, they're up north, I believe, and they find...
I just love the feeling of, like, the place where things go to die. The place where things go to rest, you know?
Well, you can go with a global warming thing, but, I mean, it's still frozen up north, and it's what you talked about. Something's being thawed out. You know, something worse. You know, global warming's not bad enough. What about the, you know, vampire kings? That, yeah. You know,
well, even the thing is pretty scary. Where you know, there's something's been frozen in there for so long. You know, no one had the technology to dig it up. We get to the point where we can scan for something under the ice, and we're dorky enough to go and dig it out, and we get in trouble.
Well, there's another movie that got made, independent film. I never got a chance to see it, but it was like Harsh Winter or something. I think Ron Perlman was in it, and it took that idea, an environmental twist. They're up north, this scientific team. They get stuck there, and something, because of the, you know, this whole global warming thing, creates this, we don't know what, and they're stuck there. But it seemed to have that same kind of spirit as The Thing.
Huh. Interesting.
And I think that really works for...
But, I mean, this is not a new trend either.
No.
Remember The Blob?
Yeah.
That's the end of The Blob. They drop it off in the Arctic and they just leave it there.
Here's another idea. Yeah. You know, winter is coming. It's not going away. And you are sent by your people to go and investigate why it's not going away. We know that for some reason it's getting colder and colder up there. And if we go to the center of where the cold is, we can find out what's causing it. It's a magical world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to go from an environment that you know really well, the tropical jungle.
Why did it?
And head up there to the center of, you know, the wasteland.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I hope this, you know, I hope this type of stuff, this brainstorming that we do, helps out with your role-playing ideas. You know, again, this is one of those environments I think people shy away from. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why you have to set your entire campaign and this type of stuff, but there's also no reason why you can't kick your players up there for a little while and, you know, change it up for them. So, whole bunch of great ideas. I think that you should go to our website, www.geekson.com, and post some more plot ideas, character ideas, non-player character ideas, sci-fi, tech gadgets. I think that would be a great place to collect all this stuff. So just keep posting there.
Post your ideas. Help your fellow gamers come up with a brainstorm.
Or writers. I'll go write a short story about, you know, this type of thing, too. Anything else? I think we should do this type of role-playing seed ideas more often. I really like this.
That was fun.
Outer space.
I'd like to do like a low-tech.
Sci-fi stuff.
Low-tech,
Low-tech, no one
steampunk.
Does low-tech.
Steampunk.
Steampunk, Cool.
Do you want to mention that?
Oh, yes. Oh, that's right. So, my wife, there's always this ad on TV for Kanoki foot pads, and I always kind of laugh at them. And my wife was at the store, and she saw them, so she bought the Kanoki foot pad. These are cleansing detox foot pads, whatever the hell that means. These pads you put on the bottom of your feet, and they're supposed to draw out impurities while I sleep.
That's bullshit.
Now, I think this is bullshit.
Yeah.
So
I actually know it's bullshit.
Kinoki! Okay.
But on the ads, they pull it off, and there's some type of debris on there.
Yeah, and I can tell you what it is. It's a chemical reaction that happens with sweat.
Okay, but it slowly goes away as the days go on, they claim. So I'm gonna document
it's the dirt
this.
On your feet.
I'm gonna
you don't
start
it
here. I'm gonna start it tonight or tomorrow.
And you'll be able to see this on KanokiJournal.com.
No,
right?
But I'll report. I'll report back here Kanoki all the bullshit findings of what happens to
make
my.
Make sure you take
foot
photos
pads.
And upload them.
Yeah, because people want to see my.
We have to see your foot leavings.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, it contains 14 pads. We'll see what happens in 2 weeks.
So okay, are you gonna use one pad? Or are you going to put a pad?
I don't know. I'm going to read. I'm going to do exactly
my
what
my right
they,
foot feels more cleansed than my left.
I'm going to do what they tell me to do in the instructions. So we'll see.
All right.
That's so bizarre.
I look forward to hearing about
it.
Let's
see the
Well, thanks
all
for having me, guys.
All the people
no
who are
stopping by.
All the people who actually have anything to do with science are crying out in agony that you actually are.
We're going to try
that,
it.
Giving
no
that
reason.
Any type of.
The thing is, even if it is drawing stuff out of your body, and that's a big if. How do you know it's bad stuff?
China. Like,
it's your life energy.
Because it's foot dark. Nutrients being drained away.
Because it's dark, and anything that's dark must be bad.
Exactly.
My blood's pretty dark.
All right. I hope everybody has a great geek week, and we will... Okay, so Comic-Con is going to be... coming up before our next show.
Mm-hmm.
So our next show is going to be a Comic-Con episode.
So we
are going to have a meet and greet in the same place that we were last time. I'm going to put out another announcement right before exactly when and where that's going to be. It's also going to be on our website in the forum section where that will be. It's going to be on Saturday night at the... I can't remember that place.
In San Diego.
It's in San Diego. I'm going to post exactly what it is. But I hope to see people who listen to our shows down there as well. Also,
any interviews?
We're going to just see. We go there and have fun. If we get interviews, we get interviews. It's kind of a random thing. I'm going to be twitting from Twitter exactly where I am throughout the day. So all of you should be signing up. There's also such a Twitter clients, and you can do it also from your instant messenger on your phone. But we're going to have a little system where we can constantly keep track of where anybody is in case we want to meet up or have lunch somewhere, that type of thing.
As a non-Twitter person, I think I'm going to refer to it as twitting from now on.
It's
twitting?
I've converted over.
It's great.
It's called twitting.
Yeah.
Oh, you're on?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I haven't signed up to you.
Okay.
Okay, I'll sign up.
Yeah, cool.
Cool. So anyway, my Twitter account is AARZNH. And what's yours?
Mine's,
do you want to get yours out?
I have like seven people. You. It's not that, but mine's Parati. It's Parati. That's Portuguese. But
okay. And we'll also post it on the forum section. There will be an official Comic-Con Twitter list, so everyone can post their Twitters on their Twitter names there. Okay.
Cool.
Anything else?
That's it.
Let's go. I'm hungry.
Like I said, thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, no problem. Welcome back anytime. I'm going to go see Batman right now.
Yes. Woo-hoo! Awesome. Cool.
Excellent. Have a good geek.
Jealous.
Bye.
Bye.
Geek it out.